Welcome, everybody, to the first session of the PI Days, which will be dedicated to new directions that are taking off in the Institute. My name is Matteo Smerlac. I'm a postdoc here, and I'm also, together with Yidun Wan, a postdoc rep. I'll be chairing this session today, and the very first step in the session will be some announcements by Lee Smolin.
Good afternoon. I'm saving the inspiration for Neil. But I want to welcome everybody here. We have two themes on Pi Day this semester. Today we are hearing about new directions, and we have four new directions followed by a session on short presentations. And I've asked twice for volunteers, and I have one volunteer. So there's lots of room if people want to come up and give a short presentation. You can have as much as 15 minutes. So please talk to me or let me know. Don't be shy. If you want to describe a new result, an idea, a challenge to us, let's have some lively discussion then. Then there's a dinner for people who signed up for it, and there's still places if you want to sign up. It's at 6:45. Tomorrow, we're focusing on one new direction, which is physics out of equilibrium, and we have four very intriguing talks on that theme, followed by a panel discussion. Now, our chairs are the postdoc reps, Matteo and Yidun Wan. And the last thing to say is to thank Amanda, our IT people, and the Bistro staff for doing everything behind the scenes to make this possible.
Now, the PI director, Neil.
Thank you, Matteo. Let me just begin by thanking Lee for putting this all together. I think we're all very excited about the prospect. I wanted to just say one thing, which is what's special about Perimeter. And you know, it's about people, it's about physics, but the most important thing is it's about playing. And this is how I feel when I walk into that building every morning. What is it? It's a big playhouse, okay? It has stairs going up and down and rooms in funny places. It's just a big playhouse. And I want everybody in this building to feel that way, that Perimeter is here to enable you all to be children, again, and to play with physics. Why playing? Well, you know, playing is something absolutely fundamental to creativity. And we all know that playing is much better when you do it more than one. If you play with other people, it's much more fun than playing on your own, okay? And so this PI Day, is really to encourage people to play, and especially to play with people with completely different backgrounds, focuses, you know, just share ideas. Maybe they're on old problems which are unsolved. Maybe you can invent some completely new problem. But it's very well established fact that the most interesting things in physics usually happen when people from very different backgrounds and perspectives play together with, you know, with an open mind. And so I think this PI Day is great. I hope it will encourage everybody to play more inside the building and to realize what a treasure house this place is. It's full of amazing people. And talk to them more, challenge them, provoke them, irritate them, tease them, and that's all part of playing. And especially me. And by the way, I don't think of myself as the inspiration. I'm the perspiration. And maybe Perimeter is perspiration leads to inspiration. So PI. So thank you, everybody, for coming. Oh, you finally got the joke. You're very slow. Let me hand over. We're really looking forward to our first talk.
Yeah, the first talk is given by Asimina Arvanitaki, and the question to you is there any fundamental physics without particles?
Of course there is. Well, you can talk about waves instead, but yeah, in a sense, you may be right. Anyway, hello everyone, my name is Mina. I just arrived here a few months ago. And as Neil said, I like to do a lot of playing. I was trained, I was trained as a particle theorist. So when you think about particles, you always think about colliding them. And in fact, the first thing that comes to mind is high energies, the Large Hadron Collider, the Higgs, and things like that. So in the past few years, I've taken a different direction. I followed a different direction that takes you to a different frontier, the precision frontier, and low energy experiments. And how can you use these low energy experiments to detect new phenomena, new forces, new particles? One such experiment is Advanced LIGO. And I'm putting this up there. This experiment is something that's already been commissioned. In the next few months, it will start its science run. It promises to be the first experiment to discover gravitational wave radiation. So it will inaugurate the field of gravitational wave astronomy, so it's very exciting. At the same time, I'm also thinking about other experiments, actually some that are even non-existent, experiments that take advantage of advances in nuclear magnetic resonance, in optical suspension of objects from atoms to macroscopic nanoscale objects, experiments that involve atomic clocks and atom interferometry. These experiments now, many of these are just proposals, but they have the great potential of detecting things like dark matter, new forces, test gravity at short distances, detect gravitational wave at a scale much smaller than the ones that Advanced LIGO. So there is a lot to learn from them. In this talk, I don't have time to talk about everything, but in this talk I will focus on these two, Advanced LIGO and nuclear magnetic resonance. And what connects these seemingly two very different things is one small particle called the QCD axion. So in the standard model, you can write in the standard model Lagrangian this term, that whose effect is parameterized, GG dual term, whose effect is parameterized by the theta angle, what we call the theta angle of QCD. And if that term is present, it creates a very large electric dipole moment for the neutron, which we haven't seen yet. In fact, we have constrained the parameter theta QCD to be less than 10 to the minus 10. So in order to explain why this parameter is very small, in the late 70s, early 80s, people turned it into a dynamical field and introduced a new particle called the axion. This particle is originally massless, but it gets its mass for non-perturbative QCD effects. And this is the formula that gives the mass. It depends on what is called the axion decay constant, which also characterizes the strength of the axion interactions. And just to give you some idea of how light this particle can be, it can be the Compton wavelength can be as large as 3 kilometers or even bigger. So people have been looking for this particle for a long time, and the main reason is that it's actually a great dark matter candidate. If this axion decay constant is bigger than 10 to the 11 GeV, it can account for all the dark matter of the universe. So there are bounds from astrophysical observations that constrain this parameter, everything below 10 to the 9 GeV. There are several experiments that have been proposed and have been constructed to probe the axion. The first one that will probe a regime that's not already excluded by astrophysics is the experiment called ADMX, a dark matter experiment that's constructed at the University of Washington in Seattle. So what I'll be talking about is two different regions of this parameter space. First, I will talk about an experiment based on nuclear magnetic resonance that probes axion matter interactions mediated by axions. These are axions with quantum wavelengths of order between 30 microns and 3 centimeters. The other part of my talk will be related to advanced LIGO. And it will have to do, and there you will detect the action through gravitational wave signatures, and it will have to do with actions with very large wavelengths, from 300 meters up to 300 kilometers. So to start, let's talk about the interactions the axion can mediate. So if you take a mass with 10 nucleons, it will generate, similar to the way the Earth generates a potential, to generate a 1 over r potential. And that range of that potential is finite. There is an exponential factor here, so it's a Yukawa potential, and the range depends on the axion mass. So if you take a spin next to this mass, it will feel a force. It will feel an energy shift. And that shift is proportional to the gradient of that potential times the spin. Again, as you see here, the coupling constants, the strength by which this mass generates the axion potential is a very small number. It's 10 to the minus 20 for one nucleon is 10 to the minus 21, from 10 to the minus 21 to 10 to the minus 27. This is the range of values, which is a tiny, tiny number. Even for the spin, again, this is a very tiny number, 10 to the minus 9, for a value that is allowed currently by astrophysical observation, and it just becomes smaller if you go to larger values of the decay constant. So this is what we call the monopole-dipole interaction. And of course, there is also an interaction if you take two spins next to each other. So this is like a magnetic monopole, a magnetic dipole interaction in ordinary NM. So now the potential that N spins generate doesn't drop off like 1 over r. It's a dipole potential, so it drops off like 1 over r squared. And again, this force is even smaller, exactly because it's a dipole force. The main thing to... Now the question is, how do you detect these very minute interactions? The first thing to notice... Yes, so if you take N spins... Now, the first thing to notice is that if you look at this coupling term, this looks exactly like an effective magnetic field coupling to the magnetic moment of a particle. So you can detect this tiny interaction either between spins or a mass and a spin by measuring very sensitively very small magnetic fields. And this is a weird, very weird magnetic field. And the reason it's very weird is that it's different between nucleons and electrons. So in fact, the magnetic field that the nucleons feel is 2,000 times bigger. It also doesn't couple to orbital angular momentum. So if you were to put a screen between the spins here, if you put a superconducting shield, they wouldn't feel anything. The interaction wouldn't be screened, sorry. And also, you cannot pick up these effective magnetic fields, for example, with a squid. So the idea is to use nuclear magnetic resonance, because what is nuclear magnetic resonance good at? To measure very small magnetic fields very precisely. So the way magnetic resonance works, you take spin up, spin down states, you put them in a strong magnetic field, and they get split by some energy difference. So if you apply a perturbation that has, at the resonant frequency between these two spins, you can cause a transition between the spins that you can detect in the lab. You can have resonant transition. In the classical picture, this is analog to spin precession. So if you apply a B field and you have spin precesses around it, and you apply a perturbation of a magnetic field that's perpendicular to the spin's orientation, the spins will start precessing around the spin, and in order for the effect to be large, the perturbation has to be at the resonant frequency. So this is a little movie that shows this. And you see that if you go to the rotating frame, this is the small perturbations, and these are the spins rotating resonantly around that small perturbation. So the idea that we had is to exactly detect this interaction just like a magnetic field. So you take a bunch of an NMR sample, which you put in an external magnetic field, and then you take a source mass. This can be an ordinary mass with nucleons or a bunch of spins. and you start oscillating the mass at the resonant frequency of the NMR sample. Then you will see a resonant precession of the magnetization of the sample, which you can pick up with a squid. Besides, this is given the size of the experiment. The reason this technique is very sensitive is because these samples can have very large densities. M can be as big as 10 to the 23 per centimeter cubed. So even a tiny signal that can be mediated by the action can be enhanced by many orders of magnitude, and then you can read it off very easily. So, and this is the picture of the actual setup. We called the experiment Ariadne. Ariadne was the daughter of King Minos of Crete. She's a person from the Greek mythology. She gave Theseus, so when Theseus went to kill the Minotaur, she was the one that gave him the string and the sword so that he finds his way, he survives Minotaur's attack, and he finds his way out of the labyrinth. So she was the brains of the operation. So this is how the setup, so you have the source mass that's segmented and it's rotating, and next to it you put a helium-3, polarized helium-3 sample, nuclear polarization. There is an external magnetic field everywhere. Of course, you have to put shields between the source mass and the sample. Of course, shields from the outside won't screen the experiment. And there is a squid here to pick up the magnetization, the change in the magnetization of the helium-3 sample. And just to give you an idea, so when there's an axon interaction, you have a B effective that's created that's perpendicular to the surface of the source mass. And the sensitivity of this experiment is you can measure a small magnetic field as small as 10 to the minus 20 tesla per root hertz. I mean, of course, this number doesn't mean anything to you, but if you compare it what it is for squids, squids are at least four orders of magnitude worse. So this is a very sensitive magnetometer, in a sense, if you were to build such a thing. This is how the actual device looks to scale. We are going to be putting the sample next to the source mass very, very closely, a hundred microns apart. This distance is roughly 100 microns here. And these are the dimensions of the apparatus. So we are imagining this is made out of some high-density material like tungsten. And this is the actual sensitivity of the experiment. So this is the product of the one monopole, one nucleon's coupling strength to the monopole coupling strength to the axion times one nucleon's dipole coupling strength to the axion as a function of the range of the force. This is what is excluded here. This region is excluded already either by experiments or astrophysical observations. And the first phase of our proposal, the first phase of the proposal is this red band here. As you can see here, the action parameter space is this band like this. And as you can see already, the first version of the experiment will be able to probe the QCD action parameter space. Eventually, it will go deep in the action parameter space, and you can see this blue line here. You can also look for this is for the dipole-dipole interaction. So the way you reach this blue line is by increasing the density, the spin density of the sample, and you make it bigger. You just make it bigger. You can also look for dipole-dipole interactions. This is the product, the interaction between two nucleons here, and this is the interaction between a nucleon and an electron. And as you can see, this is going to be the first experiment to match in the lab astrophysical bounds. Of course, we don't expect the first version to find anything, but eventually it will start probing the axion parameter space. I don't have time to talk about possible systematics. You can trust that we have thought about them. The first thing that people ask is, what about magnetic field screening? We don't think that's going to be the problem. The main problem will be systematics that come from the sample itself. Because if you have Avogadro number spin densities, you create from nuclei, you create a field that's of order 10 to the minus 4 Tesla. And you want to detect a field that's 10 to the minus 20 Tesla. So you find you, this is the main source of the systematics. We think they can be controlled eventually. Once they are controlled, they will be able to probe the, what we call the traditional action window. And I would like to say this is an experiment that has currently been, there is a proposal submitted. There's going to be an international collaboration between University of Reno, Nevada, Stanford University, University of Indiana, and the CAP Institute in Korea. So it should be coming in, the proposal should be getting into NSF in the next few days. So now I would like to talk about how to detect axions with gravitational wave detectors. And this happens through the effect of, this is based on work that I did several years ago with Sergei Dubovsky, and I'm revisiting now in view of advanced LIGO turning on with two students, Masha Bariakter and Xinglu Huang. The question is, what is black hole superaddience? So this is an effect that they've known in general relativity since the late 60s, and it's also known as the Penrose process. And it has to do with the following fact, that if you have a rotating black hole that's rotating very fast, it has a region around it called the ergo region. And if in that region, even light has to rotate. So if you throw, if you take an electromagnetic pulse, which is thrown here, if you take it through the ergo region, but not through the horizon of the black hole, the electromagnetic pulse will come out with higher amplitude than what it came in. So this is a process that extracts energy and angular momentum from the black hole. Interestingly, in 72, Preston Tucholsky suggested the following experiment. They said, okay, let's take this electromagnetic pulse and let's put a huge, perfectly spherical mirror around the black hole. So if we were to do that, what you will find is that, again, the pulse will be reflected back and forth through the ergo region every time getting amplified, till at some point the radiation pressure is so high that it makes the mirror explode. And this is what they call the black hole bomb. Of course, in realistic situations, we cannot build this. This is obvious. But yes, just a slight little thing about finding black holes and big mirrors. But turns out that if you have a massive boson, nature will do the mirroring for you. So if you have a massive boson, what happens is the boson creates a bound state with a black hole. So what acts like a mirror now, it's the particle's own mass that doesn't let it escape to infinity. So what happens, and this happens mostly for particles whose Compton wavelength is comparable to the black hole size, what happens is the particle binds itself with a black hole, and when this happens, then you start creating a huge cloud of particles exponentially growing around the black hole, sucking energy and angular momentum from the black hole. So, and at the end, you end up with a big cloud of bosons, actually Bose-Einstein condensate, of particles around the black hole while the black hole spins down. And the way this looks, if you look at it in detail, is you know how this looks. This is a hydrogen atom bound by gravity. Because unless you're very close to the black hole, the potential is just 1/r potential. So you can understand this bound state as hydrogen levels. So you have the principal quantum number n, you have the orbital momentum quantum number l, and you have the magnetic quantum number m. These are the three numbers you need to characterize the level. Now, instead of the fine structure constant, now the charge is set by the product of G Newton, the mass of the black hole, and the mass of the boson. You have the binding energy. You can easily estimate as the fine structure constant squared as the mass of the particle over n squared. But there is one fundamental difference with a hydrogen atom. Instead of fermions that occupying the energy levels of this atom, you have bosons. And if you have bosons, because of Bohr statistics, you can have, instead of just two, you can have 10 to the 70. And this is what gives rise to a very rich number of phenomena. Now the question is, when exactly does this thing happen? And it doesn't happen for all the levels. It only happens for a few. And it happens for the levels that satisfy this condition. You require that the total energy of the particle, of the axion, which is the sum of the mass plus the binding energy, is less than the magnetic quantum number times this quantity right here that's proportional to the spin of the black hole. And you can think about as the angular velocity of the black hole. I think a great intuition for this comes from an effect that you already know, Cherenkov radiation. So in Cherenkov radiation, you have a charged particle that moves through a medium superluminally, and it emits spontaneous radiation. Here, you still have superluminal motion, but now instead of the linear direction, it's in the angular direction. So now what happens is this object that does the rotation, the angular velocity of the object, is larger than the angular phase velocity of the light, or of the boson that scatters off of it. And this is exactly what the condition is. There is even a particle, even a very classical physics analog of this. So if you have a rotating cylinder, and you want to scatter a particle tangentially off the cylinder, you have to scatter the particle. The particle has to come in with less velocity than what the tangential velocity of the cylinder is in order for it to come out with larger momentum. So it's a purely kinematic effect. Okay. The other question is, how fast does it happen? As I told you, this cloud of particles grows around the black hole exponentially fast. And turns out, people have calculated this, turns out it can be as fast as 10 to the 7 times the gravitation, the infall time of the black hole. So if you take a solar mass black hole, this can be as slow, as fast as 100 seconds. So you'll ask me, is this fast, is this slow? Well, for astrophysical black holes, the dynamical evolution timescale is the Eddington accretion rate, which is 10 to the 8 years. So it's 10 to the 8 years compared to 100 seconds. So this effect has a lot of time to act and affect the evolution of astrophysical black holes, assuming you have a particle in your theory. Now this is the optimal time scale. If the particle becomes too heavy, too short wavelength compared to the black hole size, the time scale becomes exponentially large. If it becomes too light, then the time scale is a power law. Because you can think of it as a wave function overlap. This is just how much does the wave function of the bound particle leaks into the ergo region to extract energy and angular momentum. The great thing about this is that for the QCD action, which is a very well-motivated particle in our theory, if you calculate what the Compton wavelength can be 3 kilometers, which is the size of stellar mass black holes. So it's the perfect candidate particle for this effect. And black holes, turns out, are the best candidate probe of this of superradiance. First of all, again, there is nothing for superradiance. There are some great papers by Bekenstein and Jeldovich that show that superradiance is not something that's special to gravity. It can happen in electromagnetism as well. And it's a kinematic effect. So whenever the superradiance condition is satisfied, it will always occur. The other great thing is, so the question is, why don't we observe it all the time in the lab so easily? And the reason is that you require relativistic motion for the ray to be very large. And this is why black holes are great, because this is what they are. They are extremely relativistic objects. They rotate very fast. So this is how the ray comes out to be as fast as 100 seconds. The other important thing is that black holes are excellent vacuum cleaners. they clean out, they suck, their accretion rate is so slow that you don't have a lot of things around the black hole that could perturb this effect and make it not happen. So to see how this effect evolves for astrophysical black holes, you have to first know what the rate is, the superabundance instability rate. You need to know the black hole dynamics, the accretion rate, which is 10 to the 8 years. You need to know if your particle, if your massive boson has self-interactions. Because if you have self-interactions, they will affect the dynamics in the cloud. The cloud will become unstable, and then it can collapse. And it will shut off superradiants. They will also give rise, such interactions will also give rise to these collapses. Also, they've observed in the lab, because these are, because you have so many bosons, these are Bose-Einstein condensates. So this is something that you have, can have, what they've observed in the lab, they call the Bose-Nova effect. And given that we have a gravitational atom, what you expect to happen is transitions between the different levels of the atom, through, and you get gravitational waves out of this. And something that's special to axions is that they are real particles. They are their own antiparticle. So two axions can annihilate two gravitons. In this case, one of the gravitons gets eaten back from the black hole, and you get two axions annihilating to one graviton, with a black hole absorbing the energy, making sure energy and momentum are conserved in this process. So let's start now. In this plot you have, let's take what happens for astrophysical black holes. Let's follow it through. So you have a spinning black hole, and this is the mass. So let's start with a black hole that starts off with very fast spin, and this can be a realistic situation after a supernova collapse. And for this case, we've picked three solar masses. The level that has the fastest superradiance rate is the one with L equals 2. The cloud of action starts growing, the instability starts growing. You have to wait something like 100 eV before you extract a lot of energy, of spin out of the black hole. You don't need the particle to be dark matter. Quantum fluctuations around the black hole will make sure the levels are populated. So this will always happen as long as the particle has a mass. And at that point, at some point, the cloud becomes so large and it has extracted so much spin that it can no longer satisfy the superabundance condition. So it just stops and sits there. So what you end up is a black hole with a huge cloud of axions around it. And at that point, you have significant fraction of the black hole mass, which is roughly 1% 1% of the black hole mass. But even so, it still has exactly a lot of spin because it has a big size. And then you wait some more time, then the next levels start growing. You wait another 100 defaults. This process can be, these jumps can take a long time. This jump can be a year. If this jump is a year, this will be something like 10 to the 4 years. So this takes a long time. And then you jump further down till you reach a level for which the next level to grow is longer than the accretion rate or the age of the universe, whatever time scale, whatever dynamical time scale is shorter. So the first thing you expect to see if you have and this is a realistic plot here because this corresponds to an axion of roughly 10 to the minus 11 eV in mass. So what you expect to see if you had this effect, if you were to measure spin and masses of black holes, you would expect to see black holes here in this region, but not there. So you can actually place limits because they've measured spin and masses of black holes, and this is something that has happened in the past 10 or 15 years, that they've had enough confidence to these measurements. And for the QCD axion, now it constrains a parameter space where there are no experiments running that can probe the parameter space. You can exclude, basically, axion decay constants up to the Planck scale. And there is an upper, as you can see here, there's a lower bound now on on a, there is a upper bound, sorry, I'm confused now. FA has to be smaller than roughly 4 times 10 to the 17 GeV. And this is just from the gravitational coupling of the axion, which is universal. There's no way around it. And this is a plot that shows actually some analysis that we've done that's generalized not just the QCD axion, but all types of axions, independent mass and coupling constant. What we are excited about is that advanced LIGO will be able to see the signals if you have an axion that's between 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the minus 13 eV in mass. So these signals will come from transitions between different superradian modes because they can't be occupied at the same time. This energy, this radiation is very monochromatic. It lasts for a really long time. And it will appear at different frequencies than astrophysical effects. And what we've calculated here is expected events at advanced LIGO as a fraction of frequency. And, well, you can see that it reaches one. Of course, it's 0.01 the lowest. This is the pessimistic. We've taken into account some distribution, expected distribution of black hole masses and spins. So that's why there's a huge band. What it means is that this is a promising signal. And of course, even more promising is the effect of axion annihilations. So if you look at here, again, as I told you, you can have two axions annihilating to one graviton and producing monochromatic radiation. And if you look at this, is a different frequency mass. This goes between 10 to the minus 13 and roughly 10 to the minus 12 eV. This gray region is what is excluded by the spin measurements. And here you see that you can get up to 1,000 events in this experiment. So in fact, advanced LIGO can be the first experiment not only to see gravitational waves, it may discover a particle that we've been looking for 30 years. And on this note, I'd like to finish. So in this talk, I've briefly described you two different ideas. One in the lab that probes the QCD axion at short wavelengths between 30 microns and 3 centimeters. And the other idea that comes from an unexpected place, comes from the universe, uses the universe as a laboratory, and astrophysical black holes, and will probe the range of the QCD axion with decay constants close to what we call the grand unification scale. An interesting point is that if primordial radiation were to be detected, it will strongly favor the axion being present in this range. It will exclude, it will strongly disfavor all values above 10 to the 11 GeV. So this experiment becomes golden in that case. And the other interesting thing is, for the future, of course, this is a very well-motivated particle, so there seems to be a huge window between 10 to 13 and 10 to 16 where there are no good ideas. So the question is, can we, so with this I would like to close, and the question is, can we come up with anything? So thank you.
You said in the first proposal,
yeah,
you will use helium-3 spins.
Yeah.
Now, will it help if liquid helium-3 goes into a superfluid state?
Yeah.
Then you will have quantum coherence among Avogadro number of spins.
Superfluid happens at, so we plan
at millikelvin.
Yeah, it happens at millikelvin. We don't want to go cryogenic because right now, we haven't seen any advantage with going superfluid. So what we require, in fact, the first version of the experiment will be using gas phase helium-3. And the reason is that if you go to high densities, you get a lot of systematics from the magnetic field of the sample itself. And we don't know how well this can be controlled. So the blue line that I was showing, the best projected reach, uses liquid helium, but not superfluid helium, because we didn't think there was any advantages going superfluid. It's also much harder to do.
Because there were some earlier proposals to use quantum coherence of superfluid helium-3 to get some standard model parameters. I don't remember.
Say that again?
Some earlier proposals.
I'm not aware of these proposals. I'd be happy to discuss them.
For example, in atomic physics transition, you can detect parity violation through weak dipole disallowed transitions.
Yeah.
So that kind of idea was
in the we can discuss this later. We didn't see any advantages going. The important thing is to have high spin densities. And that you can get with fluid helium-3. So that's why we didn't go to superfluid helium. It's much harder to do.
So, Mina, can you go one transparency back?
Like back here?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand how is it that you have such a high number of events if you're tying to gravitational wave observations, given that you need the black hole and the rates for black hole, binary black holes, black
hole. You don't need binaries.
So you're assuming.
Yeah, of course, you don't need binaries here.
And so where do you get the population of the black hole?
These are just black holes. This is extrapolating, I'll tell you. So first of all, the reason you get so many events is because you can see events that are like almost 100, like something 100 megaparsec away. So the great thing about this, you don't need black holes in binaries. Even if the block is sitting by itself, it will happen. So you don't care.
And the assumption is that you measure for how long?
So this is assumed. So this takes this. We've extrapolated this by using the monochromatic search. So the Einstein at home, which assumes that you have, you take 25 hours of coherent integration time. And we use even the same amount of data, 120 patches of 25 hours. The important thing is that you don't care that it is in a binary, because that brings down the number of available black holes by a lot. But of course, look at the range, right? This is from 1,000, the uncertainty is 3 orders of magnitude. So it can easily go from 0 to 0. So. Any questions from the students, actually?
For sure, after the break.
Okay.
Thank you again, Mina.